Hi, my name's Meher, and you're listening to Solutions for a Better Planet, a podcast presented by EcoActive ESG. Today, we're joined by Dr. Matt Savoca. Matt is an interdisciplinary ecologist studying human impacts on marine ecosystems. He's currently a research scientist at Hopkins Marine Station at Stanford University and a principal investigator at the California Marine Sanctuary Foundation. Welcome, Matt. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is fun.
To start off, would you be able to tell our audience a little bit about what inspired you to do the work that you do today and how you got started with it?
Of course, yeah. So as a kid, I grew up in New York City, one of the suburbs of New York City. And though it might seem like a weird place to get excited about nature and animals, that's just always what excited me. You know, I'm still studying wildlife and now in an oceans context, but back when I started, I was really interested in birds and terrestrial birds, and the concept of migration got me super fascinated with the way our planet is connected and the way birds link ecosystems across the globe. It's birds that we see every day. And so, yeah, that's a kind of a brief intro as to how I got into what I've been doing for now the past, 20, 30 years already, which is just crazy to say. But so in grad school, I was doing my PhD at UC Davis. I got really interested in how seabirds find food. And the lab that I was working in focused on seabird sense of smell.
And you have studied birds and seabirds, but now also study some other bigger ocean animals, baleen whales, that you have written extensively about some of the ways that human activities affect whales and the systems that they're in. Could you talk about ways that human activities might leave a mark on the ocean or on the whales that you study, maybe in ways that most people might not think about?
Yeah, I think, one of the exciting things about studying the ocean and our impacts on the ocean is really how little we do understand about what goes on out there. That's, 70% of our planet is ocean, right? And even though we know a lot more than we used to, there's still so much more to learn. And I think one of the things that's been really exciting for me is learning new things about the ocean, new ways that humans impact the ocean, and then sharing that with people and seeing the surprise on their face that we're doing the things that we're doing. So one of the things that I've been studying over the last couple of years, for example, is the Antarctic krill fishery has become really interesting to me. So in the oceans around Antarctica, most of the large baleen whales were killed in the 1900s to the point where they were almost extinct. And we're talking about millions of individuals. So 2 to 3 million of the largest whales were killed in a very short period of time, about 50 to 70 years in the Southern Ocean. And all those whales eat krill. Krill is this little marine shrimp-like animal. And it's a very important food resource, not just for whales in the Southern Ocean around Antarctica, but for penguins and seals. So basically, any of these iconic Antarctic animals that you can think of are very reliant on krill. And for the baleen whales, it's the only thing they eat down there, more or less, is Antarctic krill. And so it surprised me to learn, not terribly long ago, a few years ago, that not only are we fishing for krill, I'm talking about large industrial trawling vessels are being sent from northern hemisphere countries, so from far, far away, burning tons of fossil fuels to go to Antarctica and take krill from whales and penguins and seals and all that stuff. I knew about that, but what I didn't know, what surprised me, was that there was no there's no regulation in place for how these boats might be interacting with the wildlife while they're doing their fishing. And so in 2022, a friend and collaborator got in touch and shared some images with me from a boat that he was on, where he came across, or they, that boat came across an enormous group of fin whales. And fin whales are these huge animals there. They grow to be 60, 70 feet long. They weigh about as much as 3 or 4 school buses. So these gigantic animals, and they ran into a pod of about 1,000 fin whales. We think it was perhaps the largest aggregation of fin whales that has been seen since industrial whaling killed most of them in the mid-20th century. So that alone was really exciting and surprising finding. But what was even more exciting and alarming was that intermixed with these whales was 4 enormous krill fishing boats, and they were all eating the same thing. The boats and the whales were all after the krill that were congregating in that area. And I just think about the idea. So imagine, you know, if you live near the coast, I live in California. And so if we looked off our coast here and we saw a bunch of whale spouts, and but then you saw an industrial trawler dragging a huge net through those whales to, you know, take their food and perhaps hit a whale if it happens, you know, I mean, there would be an uproar. People would be, you know, with signs and banners, save the whales on the beach if that were to happen, right? But because this is happening in Antarctica, where there are fewer regulations around behaviors like this, and no one knows it's happening because it's on the other side of the planet for most people, out of sight, out of mind. But it was really surprising to me that we were, A, fishing for krill in this way, and B, to learn that the fisheries that are behaving in this way, they're not doing anything illegal. There's no regulations, no laws in the books that says anything about, you know, oh, you need to not drag a giant net through the water where there are penguins and seals and whales. Like, there is just no regulation about it whatsoever. And so as a scientist, that kind of excites me of just like, oh man, we need to work on this topic. So that's just one example of something I've been working on recently about where, you know, human activity and marine life interact in this way, and you know, trying to reduce the harm that humans have on these amazing animals.
Right. So it's not just that historically we depleted this ecosystem of whales in the Southern Ocean, and now we're fishing krill in the Southern Ocean, but that potentially our interactions with whales as we're fishing this fishing the krill away from this ecosystem now could be harmful, but also are not at all illegal.
No, yeah, exactly. Totally. And I think another kind of alarming thing is folks may wonder rather, well, okay, why are we going to Antarctica and fishing for krill? And what are we doing with that krill? I've never eaten krill. And yes. The answer is, the answer is kind of strange, but we use it for two main reasons. Which is omega-3 pills, so like fish oil, omega-3, you know, but this is krill oil, same idea. So a health food supplement. And as fish meal, primarily for salmon aquaculture. And it's not even, I mean, it is nutritious for the salmon, but we have other options that are, you know, potentially less impactful to the environment that are similarly nutritious. It's because krill makes salmon pink, and we want to have pink salmon, you know, in our sushi restaurants or whatever the case may be. And so I think that's just another layer of, you know, we go to Antarctica, we fish for this krill, you know, the interactions with the whales, whatever they may be, not the greatest look, but, you know, maybe if we're doing it to solve world hunger or something like that, maybe it's worthwhile, but that's certainly not the case. So I think, you know, the more you look into this, the more you have to share with people to say, hey, can we be doing this in a better way? Should we be doing this at all? And those are the questions I like to pose to people when I talk about this topic.
Right. And it's not all bad news in the Southern Ocean, though. Some of those boats do take their own voluntary precautions, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, these companies, and now more and more companies around the world, not just krill fishing companies, want to be sustainable, right? And perhaps that's because they realize that, you know, we can't behave as we have for the last century for much longer on this planet. The planet and its ocean and the resources in it are not inexhaustible. And so maybe they're doing it for good reasons, but I think a lot of it is consumer driven, right? And so for people that are buying krill oil, right? That would probably be, on average, a consumer that is pretty interested in sustainability and health and perhaps health of the ocean and so on, and might be buying krill as what they believe to be a safer or a better or even a more sustainable alternative to fish oil. And, you know, so I think the companies respond to that. So there's one of the major krill fishing companies has listened to scientific advice, and they no longer fish within 40 kilometers of penguin colonies at the time when penguins are raising chicks, because there was some science that came out, a handful of scientific studies that came out a couple years ago that showed if there's intense krill fishing around penguin colonies at the time when these penguins are trying to feed their chicks, then the chicks don't survive as well, they don't grow as well, stuff like that. And again, I can't speak to the motivations of why the company chose to actually listen to scientific advice, but they have been. And that's been a good sign, because the governance structure in Antarctica is not particularly conducive to passing new regulations easily or at all. And so it might be up to the industry to behave more sustainably, and as a result, perhaps mitigate this issue. But why are the companies behaving sustainably? Or if they are behaving sustainably, why? I can't say for sure, but I assume people demanding it, customers, consumers, shareholders demanding it, would be a reason for that. So I think that's one of the reasons why I'm passionate about sharing this message, because our voices do matter, especially in aggregate, right, to make big moves in this business and industry world.
Yeah, this is something that I think about a lot, too. It's at once kind of disheartening that there's a lack of regulation around a lot of these things, right? Like slowing down or not fishing within 40 kilometers of a penguin colony is not a regulation. But at the same time, right, like you're saying, collective action and all the voices together can push companies and people to do better. And eventually that can drive regulation.
Oh, yeah.
We've seen
that again and again, you know, over time, whether it's with different forms of pollution, or now we have the public demanding things to be better with fossil fuels and climate change and all this other stuff. So we have more power than we know, I think. And I think it's important to remember that. But we only really have that power when we work together. So anyway, sorry to interrupt you.
No, you were also telling me about a sort of similar, well, not similar, but a ship regulation, speed regulation program that has been in place in California. To help prevent ship strikes with whales. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, again, I could talk forever about all these, you know, interesting things that maybe the general public doesn't know. But, you know, so the ocean is traversed by, I wish I knew the number off the top of my head, but I want to say hundreds of thousands of big ships every day. Many, like, if you look, you can look at a global map of large ship traffic, and you will be astonished to see essentially the superhighways that we have traversing our seas in every direction, right? And just like highways on land, there's going to be roadkill, ocean roadkill in this case, as a result of many giant ships, you know, traversing a relatively narrow strip of ocean on their ocean highways. And so one of these major ocean highways is off the coast of California, right? Because lots of big boats have to travel between Los Angeles, San Diego, San Francisco, Seattle, Portland, so on. And as a result, there's just a lot of ship traffic off the coast of California, but there's also a lot of whales. So the California coast is a very productive ecosystem, and it's home to one of the most robust blue whale populations in the world. That's one of the things I like to tell people, is that if you want to see a blue whale in the wild, I think California is probably the best place to do it. Just you have the best chance to see a blue whale in the wild, probably in California. And that's fantastic. You know, we have humpback whales that have made strong recoveries here, and gray whales that have made strong recoveries here. So there's a lot of whales in the waters off California. And that's really, really awesome. You know, not just as a marine biologist, but just as a person who lives near the coast and, you know, gets to know that these incredible animals are just right there hanging out, you know, very close to where we live. And that's, for me, that's a really exciting thing to know. But of course, you know, we have this multi-use ocean, and so there's lots of ships there as well. And we know, research has shown quite convincingly, that one of the major threats to large whales in modern oceans is ship strike, just getting run over by a ship. It's the same concept as a deer getting hit by a tractor trailer on the highway, which we know happens all the time. And so question is, how might we mitigate the whales getting hit by ships? And the answer is simple and not a new answer, which is to have speed limits, right? It shouldn't be that surprising, but perhaps it would be surprising to know that in most places in the ocean, there are no speed limits or very limited sort of speed regulations restrictions. And so boats can kind of travel at whatever speed. And when I say boats, I'm talking about the ones that are most concerning are the large ones that are hundreds of feet long or more. And, you know, they can travel at whatever speed suits them to get their cargo or their oil or whatever it is to the place on time, while also, you know, not spending too much fuel to do so. But what we found is that when ships travel over 10 knots, their odds of hitting and killing whales is much higher than if they travel under 10 knots. So the way you can think about that is, you know, in most of our highways, we have speed limits of 65 miles an hour. There's a reason for that, because data has shown that that's about a speed where, you know, a driver can respond and react better than at higher speeds and things like that. And so it's a safety reason. And so you can think of it for the same reason, except if we implement speed rules in the ocean, it would be for the safety of ocean wildlife, like whales and basking sharks and other large marine animals that we know get hit by ships and get killed as a result. And so, but right now we're not there yet. You know, most of the ocean does not have speed restrictions. So how do you, or speed limits at all? So how do you sort of incentivize maybe companies or vessels that are interested in not running over whales? And the answer is to have some sort of a social accountability or even like a competition about it. So there's this cool program in California called Blue Whales, Blue Skies. And what they have done is they are able to track the speed that all of these large cargo ships are traveling off of our coast. And they recommend, or we recommend, that ships travel under 10 knots to, again, protect whales when whales are around. And for the ships that do that and the companies that do that the best, they win a prize at the end of each year. The Blue Whales, Blue Skies program gives out a prize. And believe it or not, the social accountability between these companies, they're getting competitive about it. And so the uptake rate of this program has been fantastic and growing in recent years, not because there's some financial incentive, but because, again, I think there's this sort of grassroots incentive from the public, right? So that they can put on all their labeling, you know, that they're whale safe, or they're Blue Whales, Blue Skies approved, whatever their marketing team wants to do with that. You know, I think would be great, but also, you know, they're actively saving whales. And when they're traveling at lower speeds, they're emitting less greenhouse gas, you know, per distance traveled. So that's why it's called Blue Whales and Blue Skies. So in Southern California, in Southern California, one of the major air pollutants in Southern California that people are breathing in, the smog off Los Angeles, is just large cargo ships that are idling off the coast there. So, you know, slow ships down, we got cleaner skies, we got more whales, and the companies have, you know, for the most part, caught on and are now competitive as to, you know, who can get the best whale safe score any given year. So it's exciting to see this transition happening in real time. And the transition that I'm referring to is, you know, when I was growing up, let's say 20 plus years ago, I think it would be, I want to say unheard of, but extremely uncommon, if not unheard of, for companies to be, you know, competing against each other for a sustainability metric. Whereas now there's several examples of this happening in the real world, and this is one of them. And it's just really exciting to be living and working at this time to see, you know, industry responding in this way, listening not only to customers, but listening to the planet as well and saying, hey, look, you know, you're stressing us out. And if you just modify your behavior somewhat, it could make a great difference for us. So, you know, it's an exciting time to be working in this space for sure.
Right. Yeah. All these stories of ways that collective action really matters, like in the Southern Ocean, where we're depleting this krill population that is really important to this whale population that we previously depleted. It's unregulated, but we're still having some sorts of wins, and collective action could amplify those wins. And then on the West Coast, where we have companies that are incentivized because of public opinion in a way to slow down and prevent ship strike and prevent, you know, I guess running over ocean pedestrians is one way to put it.
Yeah.
Another way that we have been impacting our environment, and something that you study a lot of, and I'm curious to hear about, is your work with pollutants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, that's a whole Pandora's box. One of the things I think that alarms me most about the state of, you know, humans interacting with the natural world is the creation and emission of pollutants in such large numbers in ways that are in many cases totally unregulated. And you might wonder, well, why is that? I'm sure there's regulations for clean water, clean air, and there are, you know, regulations for certain pollutants in drinking water or, you know, in the air we breathe or things like that. And there are, but the thing that I learned a couple of years ago from some friends of mine and collaborators, colleagues that work in the chemistry space in one of our government agencies is that the vast majority of chemicals that are in our modern world are unknown to science. And what does that mean? Well, because you might think, well, when we're talking about chemicals, we're talking about chemicals that are, I'm talking about synthetic chemicals that are produced by humans. So how is it possible that a synthetic chemical that was produced by humans is unknown to science? That sounds impossible, right? And the answer, though, is because in America, companies can create all kinds of chemicals, chemical mixtures, chemicals that do a variety of different applications across consumer and industry spaces. And unless those chemicals are destined to be going into the human body by design, so these are things like foods and drugs, for which there is an oversight agency called the Food and Drug Administration. If those things are components of furniture or of electronics or of makeup or of food packaging, even, there is limited to no oversight as to what chemicals go in those products, how much go in those products, whether or not they leach into the air, water, and food that we, you know, drink, breathe, and eat. And so these chemicals that I'm talking about that are unknown to science, we are left reeling because you have a company that are creating chemicals that are not disclosed at all. And there's no safety testing. There's not even a chemical formula that is published because it's considered a trade secret. And how is that allowed? Because it's not meant to enter our bodies. But of course, as we've learned again and again and again, these chemicals do not obey our body's borders, right? Like they get into the water, they get into the food, they get into the air, and we find them all over the place. So there's a group of chemicals called PFAS, the per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. It's a group of about 10,000 chemicals and probably many more that are being produced in mass by a variety of companies. They have grease-resistant, fire-resistant, water-resistant properties, so they're very popular in a variety of different products, many of which we probably have in every single one of our homes, offices, and so on. But most of these PFAS compounds, PFAS compounds, are unknown to science, right? And so we know generally that there's lots of PFAS out there. Some of them, we have the chemical formula, and we know sort of how to look for them and how to test for them. But when a company creates a new PFAS compound, they are not required to share that with anyone, with regulators, with scientists, with health agencies, nothing.
Wow.
And so a lot of times the way these chemicals are quote unquote discovered is because there's a fish kill or because there's an outbreak of cancer in a neighborhood or something like that. And it gets traced back to some typically industry that is, you know, dumping chemicals in a river because it's allowed, because there's no regulation for these, you know, for the chemical that they're dumping because they created it in secret to make money. And so, you know, this is a microcosm of a very large issue, and one that I think is on the same level as climate change and biodiversity loss. And that's not just me saying that. The UN calls that the triple planetary crisis. And so, which is pollution, climate change, and biodiversity loss. So, yes, so pollution is something that is really, really interesting to me. I think it's very well studied, but I think it's not as well studied in this environmental space as, for example, climate change and biodiversity loss are intensely, intensely studied. It's been really, really interesting to work in the space of environmental pollution, ecotoxicology, thinking about how these chemicals go from production to use in products and then ultimately into the environment and then back into us through the air we breathe, the food we eat, and the water we drink.
Yeah, potentially another really important avenue as we move forward for collective action.
Yeah, and I think, and you know, there's been a number of examples where this has worked, right? I think, if you think about DDT is probably the most famous U.S. example for this, right?
Right.
Silent Spring, published by Rachel Carson in the early 1960s. And it said, hey, you know, there's a lot fewer birds around. What's the deal with that? And, you know, the long story short is that we were dousing our fields and our farms and our gardens with pesticides that impeded bird reproduction, and in particular because it biomagnified up the food chain to the point where it got into top predator birds, things like eagles and falcons and stuff like that. Those birds experienced this phenomenon of eggshell thinning, and they would sit on their eggs and crack their eggs and kill their chicks by accident, right? And so bald eagles almost went extinct. Peregrine falcons almost went extinct. And a number of other predatory birds in North America almost went extinct. And people, and as a result, then government were outraged and banned these many of these classic organochlorine pesticides, of which DDT is one. And DDT and these similar compounds, they stick around in the environment for quite some time. So we still find DDT in the environment, actually, even though it hasn't been used in America really since the 1970s. But we see it in much lower levels than we used to see it. And we now are seeing robust recovery of things like pelicans and eagles and hawks and falcons and things that we were losing, that were at risk of going extinct, are now doing really, really well because we, meaning the public, found out about this, we're not pleased with this, demanded change, got change, and now we see the result, right? We see the result where bald eagles are now in the right areas, kind of common. Like I said, I'm from New York. We have bald eagles breeding in the confines of New York City.
Wow.
You know, you have bald eagles breeding in Washington, D.C. In my own lifetime, growing up, that would have been absolutely unheard of when I was a kid. And I was interested in birds. So believe me, I was looking for bald eagles. And, you know, never would have seen that. And that's now, a bald eagle on Staten Island, where I'm from, is not terribly uncommon. And it's a really neat thing to have been witness to over the course of my own life.
Well, Matt, thank you so much for your time and for the work that you do. Just to take us out, if there's one thing that you want people to know about how their actions are impacting the things that you study or the environment around them, what would that be?
That's a really good question. I don't know if I could give an adequate answer on the spot here, but let me think about that. I think is realizing that we, meaning humanity, we are going to need to use a lot of resources. There's just no way around it. We can't not do it. So I think I would argue maybe the grandest challenge of the 21st century that we're all living in is to identify in every sort of way and facet of our lives, and I'm talking lives at every scale, individual lives, communities, nations, and globally, is how do we use resources as sort of minimally, as sustainably as possible, that allows for reuse, circular economies, circular products, thinking about the entire life cycle of when you produce something, where is it going to end up? Is it going to impact the environment? Because one of the things we've realized, and I think the general public is coming to realize over the last handful of decades, is that the environment and humanity are not separate. Some people may think of them as separate things, right? Even if you're living in the middle of a city and you don't see a tree, we are intimately linked because we are reliant on food and plants and water from the environment, right? And so understanding that this is all connected and that we're going to have 10 billion people on this planet, those 10 billion people are going to demand a lot of resources, and there's no way around that. So we need to start thinking creatively about how to minimize that impact on every system that we touch, which is really, I think, one of the most profound questions for humanity in the 21st century.
Matt, thank you so much.
Yeah, of course. Thanks so much, Meher. Really appreciate it.